two different parts of the race, the GC guys and Quickstep. Yeah, it all depends on how the race is raced, but I expect it to be super stressful, just crazy. The first cobble sections heading into that big road, the sharp left hand into the first cobble sections, for sure there's going to be 30 guys on the ground there already. It'll come back together again in the next sections just because it's too long in between sections and then the feed zone. But then once we hit the fourth sector, like the original Roubaix course, I'm assuming then it's going to start, you know, teams like Quickstep. It depends. It's hard to say if guys have a free roll or if they have to look after their GC guys. But I'm guessing, you know, Quickstep are going to use one or two guys just to do super hard tempo the whole time. We'll get to a point in the race where there'll be a big explosion. There'll be 50, 60 guys, and then just sector by sector, it'll be like an elimination race. And just I hope I'm there with maybe Sonny and Nibali, that we're in the front group, that we also can do a bit on the front and gain some time.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2018 Tour de France in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, to Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport. Today, we are in Roubaix.
Well, we open tonight's episode with the Somme Battlefields Pipe Band, who were playing at the start in Arras this morning. And then we heard from Bahrain Merida rider Henrik Hausler, who is a teammate of Vincenzo Nibali, also in Arras. And then we heard some atmosphere from the cobbles where Lionel spent the day for tomorrow's episode of Kilometre Zero. We've been reunited with Lionel now. Francois Tomazo and I have been at the finish, and we were interviewing people at the finish. So many stories to catch up on. Lionel, I think you saw the race in three different places. Was it apparent for you out on the course what utter carnage there was today?
Absolutely, yeah. The first place we saw it was the entry to sector 15, the first of the cobbled sections, and I'm struggling to remember seeing riders hammering over the cobbles quite as fast as the bunch came through there. It was slightly downhill entrance to it. It was absolutely breathtaking. And then the second time we saw them was probably it was only three sections later, actually, and already the damage was being done. Riders everywhere, cars everywhere. It was absolute chaos. I mean, hopefully I've managed to convey a bit of what it was like out there.
I
on
certainly
the
hope
cobbles
so, Lionel,
in kilometre zero.
You know, we're gonna have to.
Wow, it was kind of bewildering, really, because my eyes were struggling to take in what was going on in front of me. I mean, riders were everywhere. You'd see a group come past, and you'd think, "Blimey, that's the Quintana group." And of course, I mean, although I had my phone and Eurosport player and Twitter, signal was not great. So many people out there in the countryside, all probably trying to use their phones, so wasn't able to see a great deal of it. And so it really was a mystery each time the race came past. It looked different.
It's strange, isn't it? Did this strike you? I don't know. But sometimes when you see in the flesh something happening for your eyes, something that you know is a massive TV event and that people are watching and really paying attention to, because what's happening is important.
Well, yeah, I mean, everything was important. What sticks in my mind is the middle section that we saw, section 12, a really difficult part of the race, horrible surface. We were stood on a corner, and just seeing the kind of desperation on some of the riders, you know, in their body language, in their faces. They were really wrestling with their bikes, getting them around the corner. And unlike in Paris-Roubaix, where pretty much everyone is good at riding on the cobbles, you could see the variation in technique here. I'm not saying anyone would look particularly bad, but it looked like a kind of it looked like the Tour de France on the cobbles, and there was a real kind of disparity between the people who were coping and the people who were just about keeping their noses out of the water, so to speak. But the last time we saw it, which was at the very beginning of Sector 4, I noticed that Tom Skuins and John Degenkolb of Trek Segafredo are right up at the front and really starting to take it on. And I have said to myself, you'll have to believe me here, this isn't podcast doping, but I thought Degenkolb's going to win this.
I hope you recorded that on the
recorder. You should have done that. We require proof now. Next time you have an inspiration, please remind you, you can name all the riders.
Some recording device with you, Lionel.
Well, I was just fumbling around with the on switch at the time.
Yeah. Okay.
But the thing is, I mean, just I guess I've got to try and cobble together a tale of the attack. But it's kind of almost futile.
Well, I was going to do the tale of the attack.
Were you?
Because you've been absent.
Oh, go for it.
I'll just
excellent.
It's impossible to include everything that happened in this, but it was a stage from Arras to Roubaix, 21.7 kilometres of cobbles, which is a lot. That's the sort of insight you're listening for. Richie Port crashed in the first 10 kilometres and broke his collarbone. One of the big favourites who looked good a couple of days on the Mour de Bretagne. And that's a devastating blow for him and for his team for the second year in a row. And it was on this stage, last year, stage 9, they also crashed out. His injury this time doesn't look so bad. Greg Van Avermaet, his teammate, suggested afterwards that he might come ride the Vuelta. It's a bit too early to say, but absolutely awful for Richie Port. And Geraint Thomas afterwards said that he was the guy who they considered their number one rival. So it's a blow for the race as well. Big breakaway went and cleared. Thomas De Gendt, who'd been teasing people on Twitter, saying that he wasn't looking forward to day stage. There he was up the road with Lilian Calmejean, Jérôme Cousin, Damien Godon, All Direct Energy, Antoine Tolouc from Lotto NL Jumbo, Reinhard Jantse van Rensburg from Dimension Data. First time we've seen them in a break. Omar Frehley from Astana, Chad Hager from Sunweb, Olivier Legac from Groupama FTJ, and Nicolas Edé from Cofidis. That was a big break. Behind us, they rattled through the cobbled sections. There were so many crashes. Former Paris-Roubaix winner Nicky Terpstra came down, Michael Valgren, TJ Van Garderen was a follower. He lost 5 minutes in the end, so BMC's plan B doesn't look quite so good. Nicky's Arndt had a heavy fall. Thought it was actually Tom Dumoulin when he came off, but it wasn't. It was Nicky's Arndt. Rigoberto Urán had a shocker of a day. Dylan Groenewegen, yesterday's stage winner, came off. Jakob Fuglsang, Michał Kwiatkowski, Artur Vischoe, Egan Bernal, Mikel Landa fell on clear tarmac, a straight piece of road. It looked like he was taking a drink. Some people suggest he hit a pothole, that he was hit by a Groupama FDJ rider. Who knows? He came down pretty heavily, but saved it, really. Chris Froome came down twice as well. And there were three mechanicals for Romain Bardet, and he spent much of the day chasing. And when he wasn't chasing, he was attacking. It was just one of those remarkable days. As you said, Lionel, John Degenkolb, who you always knew was going to win, he escaped 17 kilometres from the finish with Van Avermaet, who'd been very aggressive for quite a long part of the race, and Yves Lampaert from Quick Step. They got away. There was no bringing them back at all, though there was a little counter-attack behind with Peter Sagan, Philippe Gilbert, Jasper Stuyven, and Bob Jungels. And the strongest sprinter, really, John Degenkolb, took the sprint in Roubaix. Greg Van Avermaet was second, and he was quite disappointed with that. No Paris-Roubaix winner has ever won the pavé stage at the Tour de France so far. Roger De Vlaeminck and Eno won at the Tour before winning Paris-Roubaix.
Jan Raas did so as well, I think.
What's that, sorry?
I think Jan Raas also won different years, the pavé stage and Paris-Roubaix.
Mm. Yeah. First Tour de France stage win for John Degenkolb as well. And it was his first World Tour win since the final stage of the 2015 Vuelta. And it's been a really difficult couple of years for him since his crash down in Calpe in the south of Spain when a group of Sunweb riders hit an oncoming car. So that is your tale of the attack.
A community around the world, stories and films with the most compelling characters, the world's finest apparel, explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Hi, I'm Harry from Rafa Race Radio. At Rafa, we believe that cycling transforms lives and that riding is the answer to many of our daily problems and challenges. We have 23 Rafa clubhouses around the world with more than 300 rides a week going out, attended by thousands. So wherever you are, we invite you to come and ride with us. Visit rafa.cc to find a ride near you.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, Rafa. Very grateful to them for their support. Tomorrow's a rest day, of course, and while I remember, we're taking phone calls. Leave a message on our WhatsApp number for us to answer. You will hear your question and our answer in tomorrow's press conference episode. We've been joined by...
Well, let me just give give the number so people can ring in if they've got the WhatsApp.
People guessing who we've been joined by.
+44 797 133 8205. That's +44 797 133 8205. And we'll take questions on absolutely anything about the tour or about our coverage of the tour.
We've been joined by Television's Daniel Freib. Daniel, are you just passing or have you come to...
I thought I'd come and watch the podcast.
We haven't actually said where we are. Tell the listeners where we are.
We're in the Roubaix Velodrome and we can hear commentary of the World Cup final, which I'm aghast not to be watching. It's 2-1 to France at the moment.
Well, what are you doing here?
I'm waiting because I'm flying tonight.
Oh, how the other half
I'm
live,
eh? Down to Geneva, yeah. I just went on a little nostalgic trip into the Roubaix showers, completely empty now, of course. Paying my annual pilgrimage to Roger de Vlaeminck's plaque in the Paris-Roubaix showers, and I found David Miller's accreditation. It was completely deserted. Nothing, no one in or near the Roubaix showers.
Are you sure he's not soaping up in one of the cubicles?
Of course, he'll get to a plaque, I suppose. Well, Francois, what did you make of today? We haven't really heard from you yet on today's stage. I gather one of the talking points today was the fate of Romain Bardet. Yeah, we'll hear a bit later on from Matt White. He wasn't very happy about the assistance that Bardet got.
Well, the first thing I noticed was that actually the main crashes to the main favourites, I mean, Richie Porte, Mikel Landa, Rigoberto Urán, didn't take place on the cobbles. A little bit like 2014, Chris Froome crashes, not on the cobbles. So tension, you know, and excitement and probably anxiety must be at such a level on a stage like this that they might relax a little bit when they get out of the cobble sectors, maybe the lapse of intentions of attention and they crash, because I mean it was spectacular, you know, these three leading you know, GC riders crashing on very, you know, clean roads, perfect tarmac. I mean, it was very strange, as you said. You know, Mikel Landa and Rigoberto Urán apparently both, you know, were either drinking or not really. But the thing I mean, you know, is that obviously they didn't crash these guys for on the cobbles or because of the cobbles. So and they don't. So there were more crashes on the tarmac as well. So that's the first point. Second point was Romain Bardet. I mean, I talked to Olivier Nesson about it, and we'll talk about it too, because he was the guy who, I mean, Bardet punctured three times, and he was brought back twice by Olivier Nesson, who, of course, knows this course very well and likes the cobbles. And Nesson told, well, what you mentioned, you know, that Bardet was actually feeling great on the cobbles. He was really, you know, he wanted to attack. And every time he was telling Nesson and the others, okay, guys, let's go. We attack every time he punctured. So there was, so ask him, you know, whether there was some problems with you know, Bardet's tires. And because in the morning I asked Julien Jourdi, their team director, about the bikes, the ones they were using, and the tires and everything. So, well, he said that really Bardet had checked everything pretty clearly. But the impression I had and others too was that Probably, Bardet's tires was either too inflated or maybe not enough. But I mean, in the fine tuning of that, there was probably a problem there. And he paid, you know, he paid it by three punctures and managing all this effort to actually lose only 7 seconds on the other GC rider. So it's strange, because at the same time, it's very disappointing for Bardet, because you puncture three times, lose a lot of time, but at the same time, it proves not only that he's in top shape, but in this kind of races, as he showed in the Strade Bianche, finishing second, that is more than just a Tour de France rider.
Shall we hear from Oliver Nassen?
Of course we will.
Here's Oliver Nassen, his Belgian teammate.
So Oliver, how would you sum up the day? Did you limit the damage, or it was a bad day for Romain? I mean, three punctures.
If you have three punctures, you can only talk about a bad day. But in the end, he finishes with the Froome group, which is a miracle. He punctured with six to go. I managed to bring him back just on the back of the group. So in the end, we have to be relieved. We have to be happy almost. But we came for more, and you have to be disappointed. But if you have if he has three punctures, I have one. Some guys crashed. What can you say? Not so much.
Any explanations for the punctures, or it's just the cobbles?
It's the cobbles. I mean, have you seen them? Have you done them with the bike? Okay, you
should have my car and hurt me.
Oh yeah, then you know what I'm talking about. Of course, yeah. They're not made for biking.
there was an interesting thing Oliver Nesson said afterwards to a Belgian colleague in French. He was asked whether this was, you know, more difficult than Paris-Roubaix, and Oliver Nesson and other guys, actually other couples especially, said no way, it was much easier than Paris-Roubaix today.
Easier for those guys, but not a picnic for any of the GC riders. But well, I was piecing together what was going on, and all I was hearing was that Romain Bardet was getting some outside assistance in terms of getting back up to towards closing the gap. I'm completely in the dark.
Well,
do you guys know?
Matt White was quite exercised about that. Charlie Regalius as well said that he saw Bardet getting quite a lot of assistance.
Well, he changed bikes three times.
And let's face it, AG2R have form on that score. Bardet, of course, was disqualified from Paris-Nice last year for taking a toe behind the car, and two riders were disqualified from the Vuelta last year, Geniez and someone else.
I can't remember who it was, but you're right. They did it in the past. As far as I can tell, it was not the case this time. What happened is that it stopped, changed bikes, and in the process, it's always tricky to decide whether, you know, you receive unfair assistance.
Very difficult as well on a stage like today where the cobbled sections are coming thick and fast, and team cars kind of need to be behind the front group. If the commissars had kept... Yeah.
I'm not defending Romain Bardet, but it's difficult to cling to your car on the cobbles, is it?
It is.
Well, yeah. In actual fact, I saw several instances where the team cars were hindering riders who were off the back of any group.
But we saw, I think, the Landa group and the Bardet group, you know, came back in the end thanks to the convoy of team cars behind the leading group. But had there been a barrage at that point and the team cars had been asked to wait, and there'd been a problem with one of the other GC guys in the group, it's an impossible situation in a way. But Matt White, as I said, was quite angry about it at the finish. Here's what he had to say.
Yeah, they talk about motors in bikes and problems with doping. Let's have a little bit of control with the television. It was ridiculous. They didn't even barrage that group coming into the finish line. They came back through the cars inside the last 3 kilometres. Look, if it's the same for everyone, but it hasn't been the same for everyone, so that's the issue there. Well, it's the issue. I run the bike race, but they also need to, the television need to get out of our way. I know they're trying to shoot their shots, but the priority is the bike race, not the television shots. And when television have a major effect on the race, that's just not right. This is a crazy day, a crazy race, but at the end of the day, yeah, it needs to be the same for everyone.
Matt, you weren't a big fan of this stage before it, but I guess you'll have a lot of other people on your side now, because it was a day of carnage, really. But you came through okay. Adam's okay.
We did. We came through. No one's injured. We didn't lose any time. And yeah, there's potential for disaster anywhere on that stage. But boys got through well, and Adam was very well looked after.
I guess that hasn't changed your view of the stage, though.
No, I still think Paris-Roubaix has no a stage like that has no place in the Tour de France. A couple of sectors, sure, but we've seen guys crash out today, and it wasn't. The classics are in April, not in July.
But even by the standards of a Paris-Roubaix or a cobbled stage, there were an awful lot of incidents and accidents today. What do you put that down to?
The vast majority of this bunch here don't do. It's not their speciality. In April, they're specialists. They want to be here. They know how to race on pavé. They know the risks. They know how to handle their bikes. Half of this bunch is climbers who don't do these style of racing except for today. So that's a big difference. You're putting two mixes of talent and skill together on the one stage.
Well, my impression of this stage really is just from my eyewitness account, and also from looking at the results and just digesting what has gone on. I mean, it was a sustainable meal out there today. It was like our roast duck and roast chicken that we had at your in-laws last night, Richard, and it took almost as much digesting. But on reflection, really, all of the GC riders, or a good number of the GC riders, all finished together. Richie Porte, of course, the big exception because he's out of the Tour. Landa and Bardet lost only 7 seconds. And then the only other significant loser today was Rigoberto Urán, who lost 1 minute 50-odd to... by the time you've taken into account the gap, 1 minute 25, something like that. So a bad day for Urán, but quite remarkable, really, that group of favourites all came over the line in the same group.
Especially the Nairo Quintana, Warren Barguil, really Adam Yates. I mean, really, so, you know, skinny kind of climbers will be in their element as from Monday. Who really actually no, we didn't see them, but as you know, Thomas Voeckler said at one stage in the French television report. Well, if you don't hear about them, it's good news.
Amazing to see guys like Pots of Evil, Domenico Pots of Evil, up there in that group alongside the likes of Sagan and Quintana and people like that. Warren Barguil.
Le ramasseur de pissenlits. The dandelion picker.
Well, I mean, he wasn't picking dandelions today, was he?
He was exceptional on the cobbles last time, wasn't he? To our surprise, because he's got a very upright position on the bike, and he's not necessarily the kind of guy who you would think would go well on cobbles, but he's quite loose, isn't he? As we know. Very loose.
I mean, I thought today would be a great day for him to lose a bit of time ahead of his, you know, stage-grabbing missions in the Alps and the Pyrenees. So it was kind of surprising to see him up there.
Are you ready for some ace punditry? I've noticed something. A France scored.
I think that's a goal for France in the World Cup final.
That's unless my ace punditry is that France
scored. Unless
we're
in the creation part of Roubaix here.
Have you noticed that the white jersey competition has been decimated today? Absolutely decimated. The only under 25 rider, so rider who qualifies for the white jersey competition in, well, there were two in the top 40, Soren Craig Anderson and Gaviria or Niels Pollitt as well, but no one with any real GC credentials. And the first rider that I can see who you would have thought would be in with a shout with the white jersey in Paris, Pierre Latour, lost almost 6 minutes.
Yeah, well, Soren Craig Anderson is 7 minutes ahead of Thomas Boudin, who is a sprinter, really.
He's a sprinter, yeah.
For Direct Energy. And then I think Latour is another 7 seconds back. So, yeah, you're right, Danny.
I mean, decimated means reduced by a tenth. Is that, are you being accurate there, or
well, basically what Daniel's trying to say is that Egan Bernal lost 16 minutes or something today for
a lot
Team
of
Sky.
Team Sky riders lost 16 minutes. Kwiatkowski, I don't think I even mentioned him, but he crashed. Wout Poels, Gianni Moscon, all four of them lost 16 minutes.
What, isn't that peculiar? That, I mean, Bernal is talented, but this is his first Tour de France. To what?
4-1
4-1 in the football. Let's concentrate on the cycling. But all of those resources put with Bernal, I found that quite strange to make that call so early.
Well, he was definitely protected. Sky had made no secret of that. I also noticed that his bike, so the team arranged the spare bikes on top of cars in a specific order to reflect the hierarchy of the team. Chris Froome's bike is in sort of position A on the bike, on the car. Geraint Thomas's is position B, and Bernal's is position C, which would tend to confirm that they do. They certainly were hoping that he would contend in the white jersey competition.
You spoke to Chris Froome at the finish, Daniel. What did he say? What was his mood?
He was very relieved. I think all the GC guys were very relieved. And they just want shot of this first segment of the race, don't they? And they want to get into the Alps. He had a crash, but he made light of that crash. I think it was about 45 kilometres to the...
Did he crash once or twice?
He only mentioned one crash, right. But he might have crashed twice. And he said there were times when they could have put a bit more pressure on. Where there was certainly a moment where I think Rowe was on the front. I think it was 65 kilometres to go. Rowe was on the front and Sky were very well represented at the front, and there were a lot of GC guys behind. And I thought that was the moment where they would just engage the turbo. They didn't really... But
it was Van Avermaet, wasn't it, who was the most aggressive, really?
Yeah. It's just going to be interesting to see how these teams emerge from today. You know, Mitchelton Scott went into this tour with a team stacked heavily towards this first week and today's stage with a lot of sort of classic specialists. And I think that's been vindicated in the sense that they've got a full team still and a team that's in quite good shape, but they're not going to have a huge amount of help for Adam Yates in the mountains. However, you look at AG2R and I think they might be quite depleted when they get to the Alps. Villermoz, I'm not sure if he's going to carry on. And I think they've had a couple of other problems as well.
Yeah, well, it's true. From what I heard, well, they lost Axel Domon, in the first week. As you mentioned, Alexis Villermoz lost lots of time, and he looked really, really bad in a bad way in the finish. Well, there's still Pierre Latour. I mean, it's not much, but he's a great rider, very consistent, very solid, even if he was not on his terrain today. Well, he'll be there, and what remains of the tour will be really, you know, at the service of Romain Bardet. And in a sense, my impression is that, you know, with these new teams with only 8 riders, I mean, this is something that might happen to lots of GC leaders at some stage during the rest of the tour, and probably in the third week it'll be, you know, man to man. So we'll see where, you know, it's
and Movistar, you know, they will look at this as a huge result. I mean, we always said that coming in with 3 leaders, if they can get down to the Alps after this stage with all those 3 leaders still there or thereabouts, and Quintana has lost a little bit of time, but he hasn't crashed and hurt himself, Quintana. I don't think Landa's too bad. He was smiling at the finish. I thought it was a great ride by them today. I mean, they at one point had more riders in that lead group than Quickstep, and when Landa crashed, they sent guys back with him to help him, and they did a fantastic job closing.
Well, Valverde is always at ease on the pave, but I talked to José Luis Arrieta about 2 or 3 days ago about the cobbles. He said, well, you know, we checked the course, but we didn't make any special preparations or work, because he said it's not, if you Greg Van Avermaet, you crash or you puncture, and you have it's the same problem for everyone. So we just, you know, just tackling this stage like any other. I talked also to Yvon Le Danois this morning, who is a former Movistar team director, and he told me, I can tell you they're really scared about today's stage, but it didn't show on the day. Yeah, they lost to Horas, that's true. But it didn't show on the day. I really think that, you know, there's probably some diplomatic line there. They probably worked on it, and yeah, I was impressed, by the way. Quintana on the cobbles looked very, you know, very elegant in a way. I mean, he was kind of not flying, it would be exaggerating, but he was doing all right.
The other story today was John Degenkolb, and I think a lot of us doubted whether we'd ever see him return to the level he was at before his terrible injury. He won Milan San Remo and Paris-Roubaix, didn't he? Was it 2015?
Yeah.
2015. And then at the start of 2016 had this horrendous crash. There seems to be some movement in the football.
Let's go there in a minute.
I'm not sure. There are various delays and the clumps of people around about us. But anyway, I spoke at the finish to a couple of people from Trek Segafredo. Degenkolb himself was very emotional, dedicated the win to a friend of his father's who passed away over the winter. But a big win for Degenkolb, and it was greeted very well. They were very happy at the Trek Segafredo team bus, as you can imagine, because Bauke Mollema, their overall contender, also had a good day today in the sense that he didn't lose any time in the end. So I spoke to the sports director, Stephen de Jong, and then to his teammate and good friend, Koen de Kort. What will this mean to John? He's had a terrible couple of years.
I think for John it's a big release, and it proves that that he's back for, you know, for some more action. And we saw his condition improve in Swiss, and that was really necessary because he was not certain to be selected for the tour, but at least he was doing well in Swiss and we saw a progression, and of course we were super happy to have him here.
Was this the stage that you'd sort of earmarked for him from the start of the tour?
This is a stage we marked since announcement for the whole team.
And you had another goal today, which was to protect Bauke Mollema, so a mission accomplished on both fronts, I guess.
Yes, no, the boys did a really good job. We had 5 guys on the same frame size as Bauke, and 2 of them, they were addressed to give a bike also if anything happened, and Gogol gave a bike. First the Kort gave a bike, after Gogol gave a bike. That's why he kept his time loss so minimum, and then he could always like easy return. So that was really good job.
I think it means pretty much everything to him. Of course, he definitely has had a rough time. Also going to this team, wanting to be coming to this team as one of the big guys, one of the guys that's supposed to win the big races. And of course, he's been close a few times in the big classics, top tens last year in the Tour, 2nd and 3rd on the stage. That's not really what he's racing for. He wants to win. He's a winner, and for him now to win basically nicest stage in the Tour de France for us, I think that means everything for him and for the team, and I think that means that we're back.
Have there been moments where he's worried and doubted whether he could get back to the level he was at before?
I think maybe just after the crash. I'm not sure about that, but after that, I'm sure he knew that he had it in him, but there were always some little things that didn't work out for him. That didn't happen. Either a crash or in the sprint something went wrong. Or there were always just tiny little things that didn't work out the way it was supposed to. So I think today it all worked out for him, and hopefully this sets it all in motion and makes him win more races again.
And you had another goal today, which was to help Mollema. I think you had to swap bikes with him at some point. Is that right today?
I gave my bike to him. I think on sector 4 or 5 he crashed. We were really far in the front. Unfortunately, that was a crash, and he properly smashed his bike. So I'm in position pretty close to him. So we already spoke about it before the race that if something like that happens, I would give my bike to him. So I did, and then it's game over for me. By the time I had a new bike, I was minutes and minutes behind.
A lot of teams unhappy about today's stage. It was brutal. A lot of guys crashed. I guess you're one of the few teams that are happy, but was it almost too much? I mean, we saw so many crashes.
Well, you know, crashes are obviously not nice to happen, and you don't want bad luck to influence the race, but on the other hand, I'd prefer all days like this and no mountains. You know, it's just personal preference a little bit as well, and if you want to be a Tour de France winner, you need to be able to do everything. And you know, of course, bad luck is a bigger factor in stages like these than in the mountains, but it's part of cycling, it's part of racing, and it's definitely part of modern Tour de France, I think.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. You can get your 25% off at scienceandsport.com with the discount code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. We heard just before the interval there from Stephen de Jong and Koen de Kort on John Degenkolb and his victory today. And I think you had something to add there, Francois?
Yeah, because Degenkolb, as I'm missing the most important moment in the history of French football, that's this apparently great second period. Degenkolb said there was a sense of déjà vu in his victory because he had the same guys with him in the finish. It was not exactly the same guys, but it's true that in 2015 when he won Paris-Roubaix, he was with Greg Van Avermaet, who finished third, and with another Quick-Step rider was Tibar, actually. But Yves Lampaert, that day, finished seventh. So we can imagine, that, of course, that it was a sense of déjà vu, and there's a sense of déjà vu now for France because we're going to win the World Cup.
Hang on, Yves Lampaert as well. Did you not encounter the Yves Lampaert supporters
absolutely
club,
I mean, you know, as much as Lionel had this intuition that John Degenkolb would win Paris-Roubaix the stage today, I had this impression Lampaert could do well, and he did well, you know, finishing third and being in the leading group in the finale. And I recorded the song and the chants of his fan club.
Let's hear it. So that was the Yves Lampaert fan club in Arras this morning, a premonition obviously. He was off his bike at one point today as well and got back on. I think, I don't know if he crashed or punctured.
Yeah, I think it was a puncture. I mean, it's always difficult to say, you know, in the mayhem of the hell of the north, but I think it was a puncture.
Great ride by him though. I think he's ridden really well at this tour, his first Tour de France, and big talent. You know, I think he's somebody who they'll be grooming as a future Paris-Roubaix contender.
I think, he'll be winning in this very velodrome at some point in the future, I'm sure.
Likes tractors, didn't he? I wondered if his fan club had all turned up on tractors in Iran.
Didn't see them.
We saw a lot of tractors out there today.
Yeah, they probably were not accredited. I mean, Lampaert's tractors.
No tractors in the Tour de France. Anyway, what else have we got? You spoke at the finish to Jim Okovitz, the BMC boss. Now, Greg Van Avermaet, who goes down to the Alps with an increased lead in the yellow jersey, he hinted in the press conference, I think, that he was going to say something about his future tomorrow and that it could be with whatever the new BMC team is. Hugo Kurowitz, our colleague who works for Het Nieuwsblad in Belgium, asked him quite a loaded question about whether there'd be an announcement about his future tomorrow. He strongly hinted, I think, that there would be and that it would involve whatever the current BMC becomes. But you spoke to Jim Okovitz at the
first. I thought he would be miserable because, let's face it, losing his leader on day 9, exactly the same as last year, it's really troublesome. I mean, I've never, you know, hidden the fact that I'm a great fan of Richie Porte. He's a great man. He's a very, you know, nice person. I think he's a great champion who deserves much better than he's ever done in Grand Tours. Is he unlucky, or what's wrong? You know, why does it always at some stage, you know, crash or has a bad day? I mean, he's getting older. He's what, 32 now, I think. It's going to be more, you know, trickier and trickier for him to win a Grand Tour. And it's a real pity. I mean, he kind of, you know, well. Missed out in a way. We don't know about the future, but we'll see. And I found it very frustrating for the BMC. TJ Van Garderen, when Richie was forced to abandon, looked like he could be, you know, the plan B of BMC. But today he also punctured three times, crashed, well, looked absolutely miserable at the finish line. You had the impression that being the leader again, position is always, well, kind of was reluctant to take upon him. Look, he looked like a new burden. Probably he looked almost more miserable at being the leader again than his crashes on the day. And to top it all, Greg Van Avermaet was dreaming of, you know, winning this stage with a yellow jersey on, and he was beaten by Degenkolb. So I thought, you know, Jim Okovic would be absolutely devastated, and he was not. So, which could hint that maybe there are some good news for the team, and we'll probably learn in the next couple of days. But well, maybe listen to Jim Okovic.
For the team today, I suppose it's a huge disappointment as a whole.
Well, you know, of course we were waiting for the mountains to see what Richie could do. Disappointment, but not the end of the world, and we'll carry on from here.
Yeah, sure. Keeping the jersey is something, but
it's a lot. It's more than just a little something. It's a lot. So we're proud to be able to have retained it again today, and we go on to the rest of the day tomorrow and lick our wounds and carry on.
What's the plan? TJ maybe in the mountains?
Well, we don't know yet. We get back to Annecy and take a little rest, and we'll figure that out tomorrow night.
Very unfortunate again for Richie Porte, as you say.
Who's 33? Crashed his corner.
Excellent, excellent. Live sub-editing here. Very unfortunate. Crashed last year, didn't he, on the descent into Chambéry. That was a mistake that he made on that descent. We don't know what happened today, but to crash in the first 10 kilometres, I mean, that really is devastating for him, because for the second year in a row, he doesn't get the chance to see how far his form could take him in the mountains. And I think that's a big thing for the riders, is that they want to at least be found wanting in their legs rather than crash out before the tour really gets going. But fair play to BMC, Greg Van Avermaet. They didn't feel sorry for themselves. I mean, Van Avermaet was several times that I did get to see a little bit of the action on a screen. He was looking incredibly strong, and even though I thought Degenkolb looked better, they've had a great first week, and as you say, he will take the yellow jersey into the mountains. But what I wanted to just talk briefly about was how here we are at the end of the stage that everyone was fearing, really still much of a muchness. Uran's time loss is the biggest, and yet that's not insurmountable. It's not like he's lost the tour today. He's just conceded ground to everybody else. What was remarkable was the way the teams and the riders contrived to all finish in that group together, and you saw just how hard Movistar worked together as a team. But then Mitchelton Scott surely deserve a mention for getting Adam Yates round in that group as well. They picked a team which is full of classics type riders, and Yates, you know, probably half decent on the cobbles really, but as a small guy, pretty vulnerable. And well, when you think about, you know, swapping bikes and that kind of thing, all of his teammates tower over him, you know. So
Mikel Nieves is the only one, but
yeah,
he lost.
So from a logistical point of view, just having a puncture, even having a teammate with him, it would be a wheel change rather than just a bike swap, you know, all of those things. But Mitchelton Scott really put a lot of thought into how they would get Adam Yates through today. But then you have to also mention Bora Hansgrohe, Micah finishing that group. Rafa
amazing.
Micah,
yeah.
Again, he is comfortably in the top 10. We've barely seen him. I'm not going to use our cliche about riding a la Zabeldia, because I think you've got to get into the mountains before that description applies. But they must be cock-a-hoop to get to the end of the first week and still be in such a good position overall. And Dan Martin, a word for Dan Martin. Mm. I mean, torn to shreds yesterday in that crash. I must have been in a lot of discomfort. Got through the stage and then tweeted a sort of triumphant, what a day tweet, because one thing you kind of realise when you see it out there, what an experience it must be to ride these roads in the Tour de France. You know, Dan Martin's never ridden Paris-Roubaix and very unlikely to ever ride it, and this really is may well be a sort of once in a lifetime experience for him.
That's astonishing, because you said, you know, when I mentioned the fact that for the specialists it was a very easy day compared to Paris-Roubaix, but from the climbers or the non-specialists I can kind of talk to when they finished, the ones who didn't have any problem, they really said they had fun. It was a great fun discovery for them. So, well, in the end, you know, well, if it could, you know, maybe push a bit more riders to try their luck at the cobbles and the cobble classics, why not? You know, it would be a good thing.
The one guy who we expected maybe more from today was Vincenzo Nibali. You know, he's been quiet, but apparently very strong. We heard from Henrik Hausler at the start of the episode, and he was talking about just what a great bike handler Nibali is and how he'd been so impressed by him in the first week of the tour, how he would lose Sonny Colbrelli their sprints sometimes, but if Nibali was supposed to be on his wheel, he was always on his wheel. And he was pretty invisible today. The one moment where there was a split, he was actually caught behind it, as was Adam Yates. And we probably expect a little bit more, but based on the 2014 stage here where he laid the foundations really for his Tour de France victory, he's not lost anything. You know, as you say, Lionel, if you look at that top 10, I mean, Geraint Thomas, Alejandro Valverde, Maika, Jakob Fuglsang, Chris Froome, Adam Yates, Mikel Landa, Nibali, Roglic, Mollema, Dumoulin as well, Bardet even, they're seconds separate them really. So it's all pretty you know, evenly balanced and poised really for the mountains. So it's to the mountains we shall head. We're going to drive to the mountains tonight, aren't we? Not all the way tonight. We're going to break the journey, but yeah, we're heading down to Annecy. A final shout out for our event tomorrow evening. If you're listening and you're going to be in the Annecy area on Monday night, then drop us an email, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. If you can come along, I think we're expecting a decent crowd of people tomorrow. And then we're doing another event the following night as well at Chalet La Giotaz. And we will do our press conference podcast tomorrow with your messages that you leave on the WhatsApp number, and resume our daily podcast on Tuesday, when we'll also be covering La Course, the women's race, and that'll be for the Cycling Podcast Féminin later this week. Kilometre Zero resumes tomorrow as well, doesn't it, Lionel?
It does, yeah. My day on the cobbles. Well, it has to be heard to be believed, I think.
I can't wait to hear that. I hope you recorded all the right bits.
Well, I didn't really have much choice on what I recorded. I just recorded wherever I was.
Okay, great. Excellent. Look forward to that. Thank you very much, Francois.
Well, I might wrap it up with a small little bit of French flavour.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I
mean,
forgot.
No, I mean, Roubaix, there's not a lot to add about Roubaix because it's so well known to cycling fans that I'm not going to. But if we're on a little, I'm not going to sing La Marseillaise, but I'm going to sing On est les champions, on est les champions, on est les champions, on est les champions, on est les champions. And this, I wish you a very good night. While it's coming home, he had to work up is.
I don't know what the audio equivalent of stunned silence is, but this is it.
You have been listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2018 Tour de France. Thanks to our sponsors, Rafa and Science in Sport. The music is by Santoré. This episode was produced by Will Jones.